2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 331, Virtually Mormon, Mormons and the Internet. Panel consists of Hugo N. Orleis, Scott Denhalter, Mark Fisher, and Scott Kenny.
And that's www.saintswithouthalos.com. And the website contains articles, biographies, primary sources, and a really neat collection of pictures. All of this related to Mormon history. There is a little ad in the program where you can also have you have the name of the website if you want to go. Next, we have Scott Denhalter. Scott Denhalter is a general manager of LDSnet and the mayor of Mormon Village. And the website is www.lds.net. LDS.net is a filtered internet service providers for Latter-day Saints. Mormon Village is mormonvillage.com is a website that includes Mormon news, editorials, biographies, reviews, and tips on topics such as provident living, home teaching, and visiting teaching. I'm Hugo Olias. I'm a graduate student in Berkeley, California, but living here. And also launching a website. My project is to do translation, web-based translation, using the internet as the communication medium. We are going to start with Mark. We decided that some of the basics, some of the issues go on it, some kind of order, and we're going to start with Mark. Each one of us is going to talk for about 15 minutes, and then hopefully we're going to have 15 minutes for questions.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting that I get to go first, because the questions that I'm going to try to address are some of the founding questions that are later. Then we'll be able to build upon some of these questions, and maybe that'll help us in answering some of the questions that that these gentlemen will then try to respond to. In 1996, I was a student at BYU, and like most unmotivated students, I spent a major portion of my time on the computer, trying to set new world records for the fastest win in solitaire, of course, and among other things. But it was at this time that I was introduced to the world of the internet. I was one of those late bloomers in the internet world. I didn't jump on until 1996, and at that time I was introduced to the LDS culture that is prevalent on the internet. And I found several different things. I found people bearing testimonies, and people breaking testimonies. I found singles reaching out for the one, and genealogists searching for anyone. I found scriptures to be searched, folklore to be gossiped, quotes being quoted, and books to be consumed. And I even found to buy a myriad of odds and ends pertaining to LDS culture, from a thick ring-like structure, maybe you've seen this, for missionaries they can put on their ring and go up there and knock on the door so they don't get calloused fingers. Whether that's necessary, I don't know. From that all the way to out-of-print books, that, important books on history and doctrine within this LDS culture. But needless to say, I found a vast proportion of, a vast population of people that were bonded together by this common thread. The common thread being Mormonism. Now, before I begin to hit on some of these questions, I got to throw out some disclaimers. The first disclaimer is that what I'm going to present are not necessarily hard facts. We have on our site put out some questionnaires for people to answer, but because of the nature of the people that visit our site, it may not be very may not tell the full story of what's on the internet. So I'm going to actually throw those out. We use that for advertising purposes and of the such. But most of what you're going to hear from me is going to be personal observations, because I'm the database manager. We have probably about 10 sites a day that are submitted onto our site to be included in our database. And then I also go out in the internet myself looking for sites to include in the database. And in that experience, I get to view quite a very large array of internet sites. I get to see just about everything that's out there. And so this will be from personal observation. My second disclaimer is I do come from a conservative background, and my views may not fit with some people and the way that I see things, and I would hope to hear some feedback on some of those views that I express from some of you when questions begin to be thrown out. But I do hope to present an honest view, unbiased, I would hope, of telling you what is out there on the internet. First, I need to throw out a little etymology here, okay? Community, the word community, because we're going to first talk about the communities that are out there. And the community, of course, the first four letters, C-O-M-M, talks about common, things that they have in common. Now, the question I have to ask, and hopefully we can answer here, is there one community? Are there many communities? And who makes up those communities? Now, it is one community if you feel that the common thread is the general topic of Mormonism. But, of course, there are many if you consider the purpose of your being on the Internet as you are searching online. Now, what I've done is I have divided up the Internet, the LDS community, into several basic communities. And I've given them each a two-word moniker name, okay? And what I think would describe these communities the best. Hopefully I'll give you a little bit of the demographics or what I've seen as I've been online of what these communities, who's included in these communities. Now, the first community, this is the community wherein people meet with and talk with others within the larger Mormon community for social purposes. The two-word moniker name for this is the meet-and-greet community, okay? This is the meet-and-greet community that's out there, and you'll find that this community is usually a younger community. It includes support groups, cyber daters, I like to call them, mission alumni pages, these type of people that are out there just to meet and greet. And that's what the purpose of the Internet is for them in within the perspective of Mormonism. That's the first group. The second group would be for personal study of doctrinal, historical, and social Mormonism. I call this the learn and yearn. This is a varied community. The ages and the demographics and the religious backgrounds are very very broad in this community. Number three is those who are there just to find resources for lessons, talks, scouts, etc. I call these the see and flee community. They come in, they see and find what they want, and they promise to never return again. They're looking for one exact little resource, and that's all they're looking for, and they come in and they find what they want, and then they're gone. These are teachers, scouters, young men and young women leaders looking for that perfect dating idea to get passed on, and for those that were called by the bishop a week before to tell them they have a talk they're supposed to give this Sunday. So they're looking for someone that has a recipe talk for them to give in church. That is the see and flee community. Number four, there is the community that is there to do genealogical research. I call this the prevalent and convalescent community. The reason why I give it that name is this is the largest, I believe, LDS community there. This is the biggest purpose of the Internet for LDS members, and I call it the convalescent community because it is an older group that uses the Internet for that purpose. I use it for that purpose, so I guess you could call me convalescent. Number five, this is the group that is there to discount or discredit Mormonism historically or socially or doctrinally. And I must add to this, there's a growing counter community to this also. It is a very fast growing counter community to this, and I call this I call this the thrash and bash community. Now, there are a variety of ages, of course, and a variety of religious backgrounds, and I'll tell you in a minute some of the connections there are. With these other, all these communities, how they connect to one another. And there's some interesting connections with this community with other communities. And I hope you know that I say that with a little bit of a smile. So that, but I call that the thrash and bash community. And finally, I have the community that is there to buy or sell Mormon-related merchandise or services. And there's not a two-word moniker for this community. I've come up with a lovely name for this community. I call this the testimony community. They're there just to sell you something or for you to buy it. And name it, it's on the internet. If you want, I found one this last week. I thought it was very interesting. A gentleman has put on an internet site where he is selling flags that were the LDS flag of that the church used, I guess, back in the pioneer days. And I'd never seen it before, never heard of it, but he's selling this flag. And so I think it's called MormonFlags.com, I believe is the name of the site, but it's pretty interesting. Now, there are several missing communities. If you take the communities that you see in the real world and you compare the communities that are online, these are some of the communities that I find lacking. Of course, there's the community of children. Because of technical issues, you're not going to find a lot of sites that are going to be necessarily directed towards or from children. But some of the more interesting and not so obvious ones, there's the community of new members, people who have just joined the church, I feel is a very small community. I don't know how to answer that, why, but I find very few new members using the LDS community as a resource. For some reason, most have either been members for a while or have been studying Mormonism for a while. Then there's also the investigator community is lacking, and I feel I have an answer for that. Why there's not an investigator community that is within this? Most people who join the church, if you think about it, become acquainted with the church through unplanned processes. Let me explain. I'll give you an example. Missionaries knock on a door. They weren't expecting the missionaries to knock on their door. A member at work asks them a question that they weren't planning to have to answer. Or they see a commercial on TV that they didn't turn on the TV to watch. They're unplanned events. And though surfing is a word used to describe internet browsing, most individuals use the internet with purpose. They're there for a purpose. And there's not a lot of chances to accidentally come across LDS material on the internet. I believe that there's not a lot of people who go online to actually search out for investigator purposes in the church. But other than that, the communities, I feel, really match the world and what is here. I hope that provides a baseline to springboard our conversations. Now that I feel we have these communities set and who they're there, I feel we can move on and start asking questions about these communities. Thank you.
This is Scott Kenny speaking, for those of you who are listening on tape, both of you. I think Hugo and Mark have beautifully illustrated the disadvantage of the internet, and that is the disability of putting a human face and soul and spirit online. I like to meet people and press the flesh and look in their eyes, and I think most Latter-day Saints do, because that's the kind of community we have grown up with or belong to. So Mormonism online is kind of a handicapped, I believe. On the other hand, there are huge advantages to the internet also. Let me read Hugo's initial mailing to us about some topics he suggested, and I'll read to you the one that I went for. Authority, control, and dissent. What is the official website like? To what extent should the LDS Church control Mormon discourse in the web? The closing of unofficial websites, a good idea or a bad? Is the internet the last refuge of free-thinking Mormons? Are radical ex- and anti-Mormon websites a threat to Mormonism? They're excellent questions, and I hope each of you are starting to answer those questions in your own mind. Let's go back to the first one. What is the official website like? How many of you have visited the official website of the church? Almost every single person. Terrific. Then in the question-and-answer period, you can answer this question. My experience is basically it's a website oriented towards non-members and giving them ways of contacting the church, giving a really nice, slick presentation of things that would that investigators might be interested in, or the media. There is one really nice historical thing about the pioneers' trek to Utah, which I really enjoyed. It's slick, and it's got some really nice quotes, and I found it quite interesting. My main emphasis is church history, and so that's what I tend to look for. And in that regard, I found it disappointing, but understandably so. I don't expect the church to get into church history very much. Although, I understand, Dean Jesse's third volume has been approved, and not only is that going forward now at Deseret Book, it's been sitting there waiting for years and years for approval. But not only that, but several other Mormon scholars have been invited to participate on the program to push the Joseph Smith documentation forward rapidly. And that's very heartening. I look forward to that very much. So I guess my reaction is, what is the official website like? Is that it's predictable of what one would expect from the church presenting its face to the world. To what extent should the LDS Church control Mormon discourse in the web? An easy answer is it can't. But I think that's related to the closing of the unofficial websites, a good or a bad idea. I suppose that depends on who you are. My personal take on it is that, trying to look at it from the perspective now of the church authorities and the church trying to achieve its official objective, I think it was probably necessary, at least to begin with, because it just sprang up and there was no control, there was no clear set agendas for what should be on official church websites, you know, wards and stakes and so forth. I hope that they will get to the point of setting some guidelines and maybe offering some support for stakes or missions or whatever to have their own localized sites that would give people more locally more opportunities to explore what's available to them there, other than just the names and branches and how to get hold of the missionaries or how to get hold of the meeting, where the meeting houses are. I think that's an opportunity for local members of the church to be creative and do some good missionary work in their own areas, you know, just from the official church objectives. I suppose it's a measure of how much does the church trust its members to do that and not go askew. The askew people will be there and are and will be forever now. I don't think that will have a significant impact on the face of the church. I do not believe that Mormons are like Eastern Europeans waiting for a crack in the wall, and now that we finally have the internet, we can get the truth. You know, the church isn't like that, and I don't see the general membership of the church coming to websites for Sunstone type of information. I believe that Sunstone has a terrific opportunity, and they've got a marvelous start on Sunstone Online, and William is really to be commended for the work that he's done on that. I think that website could be turn out to be something really marvelous for the more liberal or moderately conservative members of the church who want something more beyond the church manuals and conference talks. Is the internet the last refuge of free-thinking Mormons? No. Sunstone is still here and Dialogue is still here, and but it is an important refuge in a way. My first experience with the internet was starting an email list of people. I got on to Mormon Ill and said, basically, I'm interested in communicating with people who are either very liberal or apostate about how they feel about the excommunications and what does this mean to our spirituality. And I'd like to have it be a confidential site where we could share our own experiences with one another. It's definitely not intended to be a church bashing thing and so forth. I found there were a lot of people in pain at that time, as I was. That was my initial reason. I just needed to talk to people about what was going on and what it meant. 93 and September of 93, and that provided a very important outlet for quite a number of us for quite a while. I think we had an opportunity to meet one another from all over the country, and I stayed in it for over a year and made acquaintance with marvelous people. The internet in that regard, I think, is problematic in that you meet new people and you find out what their issues are and what their interests are and so forth, and they become predictable to you, it's hard to maintain interest. And I think that's one of the disadvantages of the internet. Maybe it's just my own personal commitment issue. I think one of the great resources that Mormon history, that the internet makes available, is along the lines of research and documentation, which is why I started my website, and I hope others will follow or participate in mine, because that the possibilities for putting Mormon history online are endless, and I'm really excited about it. It just takes a lot of work and a lot of patience, and at this point there's no way of making a living at it. So personally, we're living off my, mooching off my wife's BYU salary. But it's something that is kind of the fulfillment of my life's desire, which is to be fully engaged, full-time, doing Mormon history. Okay, let's see if there's another. I've got off the topic here. Are radical ex- and anti-Mormon websites a threat to Mormonism? I don't believe so. I don't see Mormons going to those kinds of websites. Is it a threat to the potential of the missionary work? Possibly.
Yeah.
I think so, because ministers or anti-Mormons, when they hear a Mormon, someone is listening to the Mormon missionaries, can say, well, go to this website and look at this stuff. And that could become problematic, I think, for the missionaries. How does the church counter it? At present, it's not. I don't know if it will, because in order to counter it, they have to acknowledge certain historical or social issues, and they would just rather not deal with them, but rather have people approach the church from this nice public relations perspective and ignore the rest of it. So I think it may be a threat in terms of missionary work, but I think the public relations arm of the church is doing such a good job with television ads and radio ads and so forth and so on, that the anti-Mormon stuff won't have that big of an impact. That's my personal opinion. We'll have to see. I don't know how to measure it. It would be nice to know. Okay, Scott Denhalder, next.
I was assigned to discuss the pros and cons of internet life for the Latter-day Saints. That's a pretty broad range of topics. I'm going to try and keep it down to two different topics. One of them sort of bleeds over into Scott Kenny's discussion about church control of the internet, and if that's Scott doesn't believe it's possible, but I think it is possible, and in fact is happening. But nonetheless, one of the difficulties of the internet, or one of the cons of the internet that I see, is the lack of valuable content on many of the websites on Mormon Village. I know that the people who write these articles are they've worked hard. They've you know done their best, and they're very pleased to be published. But by and large, it's usually pretty mediocre stuff. I sought at one time to counter this by coming up with some sort of an agreement with BYU Studies and Dialogue and Sunstone and the Journal of Mormon History and the like, where we would create a newsstand. I even set up the spot, and we got it all ready for the data, you know, for data entry, so that we could. You could go to the newsstand and you could pick up a copy of the Mormon Village Dispatch, which was basically just kind of news and faith promoting stories and things like that. But you could also pick up a good. You could see a full article from a past issue of the Journal of Mormon History or something like that. And that became troublesome simply because some didn't want to participate, but others who were willing to participate, there was no centralized. Like for instance, if you publish in Dialogue or in Sunstone, the author maintains the ownership, and so now it's decentralized. I can't just call the offices of Sunstone and say, "Can I use this article?" and or many of the other publications. I've got to find the author, which requires me then to write, say, Sunstone. They pass the letter on. And then that's financially problematic because it requires a larger staff than I have, which I should say that I had, which was three people. But there is a difficulty there. I noticed that, for example, I go on to I'll just be blunt and mention the website's names. I've already been quite frank about my own site. I get onto Meridian Magazine, for example, and Scott Proctor seems to know some people with pretty big names in the church. Not within the church, but, you know, who have published through Deseret Book and that sort of stuff. So they have names that are recognizable to the general public. But what is actually produced there, again, I find kind of mediocre. But to their credit, very polished. It's a nice-looking site. Ours is kind of, you know, dumpy and grungy, but theirs is a very nice site. And but again, getting back to valuable content, content that would cause me or other visitors to actually print the article, print the piece, and put it in a filing cabinet. I don't think that happens. And I think that may be an insurmountable hurdle. It may be that what will remain on Mormon-related websites will be mediocre stuff, simply because there's a psychological hurdle that we have to overcome with authors who are deep thinkers and scholarly and studious in what they write. And that psychological hurdle is the cachet of being published in print versus the lack of cachet being published on the internet. And I don't know that that will ever be overcome, because there is virtually no assurance that what you're reading on the internet is responsible, scholarly, or even remotely true. And that presents a certain difficulty, I believe, for those of us who want to get information. I have found that for myself, for my own investigations into doctrine or history, I find that the mailing lists prove to be much more rewarding than the websites do. Let me mention one particular website that I thought was a great idea, and I wanted to imitate it on Mormon Village, but again, there were cost prohibitions, hiring someone to do the scanning and then do the editing, and that's getting into probably what you're doing, Scott, which is getting documents onto the internet. I picked up what happened was maybe you've been to Mormonism.com, John Hayacek's site, and I don't know if it's still there. I think it's not there, but not the site, but the particular particular pages that I saw. It was a comparison of the original Book of Commandments with the DNC verses that were then published in when the DNC was first published,
35,
and then today's DNC, and I think they put in green. They wrote words that were added were in green. Words that had been deleted were in red. And it was verse by verse. You could look at it across the table, and I thought, man, that's a great tool. So I found someone who had a first edition Key to Theology, and thought, you know, I know this has been altered. I know this has been changed. I have, you know, an altered version because I can't afford a first edition. So he let me scan it and start on that project, you know, to do a similar thing. Again, it breaks down where your three people just can't handle the big dreams that you may have. But that's something, that's kind of a counterexample of what I'm talking about. I found that not to be mediocre. I found that to be relevant and important stuff. I think that this might be a possibility for a website in the future where you actually do get to see how documents have changed. Maybe it's not as controversial as you heard it was. You know, maybe it is a little more surprising than you expected it to be. But as our seminal doctrinal documents do change and are altered for various reasons, some theological, some just political, I think it's good for us to be able to compare them and to absorb the information, ruminate over it a little bit, and come to a realization, okay, maybe my slant on this particular Mormon doctrine is based upon a document, or based upon a scriptural phrase that appears to me to be all too clear, but actually isn't all that clear because it's evolved. That's a good site, I think, something that will do that. I find that the mailing list, back to that concept, the mailing list seemed to me to be very, very profitable for me personally. Someone will say something, I can ask, you know, where in the heck did you get that? And then they email me privately with an attachment, and I've got the whole document right there. If I want to go verify it, I can go to the archives, or I can go up to the Marriott Library or whatever, but I can check on that kind of thing. And actually, I can't tell you how invaluable that's been for me, and I think for a lot of people. One of the cons, let's talk about mailing lists. One of the cons of the mailing list is also a plus. It's kind of two sides of the same coin. When you get onto a mailing list, they don't know you. They don't know what you look like. If you're particularly ugly, they don't care. If you're particularly beautiful, they don't care. They don't care how well you dress or how poorly. They don't care what car you drive. Maybe they do care, but they can't know. So the anonymity allows you some level of equality. And it allows you, especially if you get on the more specialized lists, for example, I'm on LDS Phil, which is a philosophical discussion group. I tend to lurk rather than making comments because I don't have a background in philosophy. I've just kind of, you know, read popular works of philosophy, and it's fun to read. But occasionally I will make, you know, I'll say, oh, I know something about this, so I'll make a comment, and they don't really know that I'm a dilettante. They, you know, oh, I guess this guy is a philosopher as well. No, I'm a dilettante, and I'm able to basically mask that lack of knowledge, and have people actually respond to things that I say. And I have to smile sometimes because when I read their response to me, I also get to read at the bottom of the page what it was I wrote, and I look at what I wrote and I think, ooh, I did say that. You know, they must know I'm an idiot now. LDS people are usually, if you're not attacking the church, or you're not attacking someone who's attacking someone who's attacking the church, they're very friendly. And I haven't been beaten up once on LDS. So, and I cannot exaggerate the difference between me and the actual PhDs in philosophy that are having these discussions. And if they are aware of the difference, they're not telling. So I find these mailing lists, the anonymity of the mailing list to be very liberating. The difficulty with mailing lists is that they can't hear your tone of voice, and very often offense is taken where none was intended. I don't have a story about offense taken. But I do have kind of a fun story about a comment that I made on an old LDS bookshelf thread. This LDS bookshelf was a great, in fact, I think it still exists. It's just by invitation only. Keith Irwin is here if you want to talk about that. It was basically designed for Mormon book collectors of Mormon books. And The thing eventually kind of divided, so now there's the Mormon Library and the LDS bookshelf. And the Mormon Library is more toward more a discussion of the content of the books, whereas bookshelf is more a discussion of the minutiae of collecting, the value of books, the care of rare books, etc. But while it was still kind of joined in there, and there were novices like myself on the bookshelf, someone was discussing the Deseret Book reprint of the first edition Book of Mormon, and someone complained that, now you got to understand, these collectors can be very picky, and someone kind of nitpicked about the fact that Deseret Book chose to use pigskin instead of sheepskin, which the original Book of Mormon binding was. Sheepskin, not pigskin, you know. As a joke, I said, well, obviously, you know, you haven't read the Porcine Protocols, and I just kind of hinted that it was an esoteric document that had been given to Joseph Smith by Alexander Nybar, And I really wasn't at liberty to divulge the contents of the book. There was only one English translation available, and the church thinks that they have it in their vault, but they don't. I can't say where it is, but the upshot of it was that there were various doctrines that were very deep and very very much linked to one's exaltation. And somebody wrote back that I think it was Will Bagley wrote back that he'd been at a book signing for one of his books, and that a couple of men in brown polyester suits accosted him in the alley afterwards behind Zion's and said, "We understand you know Scott Denhalder. You give him this warning for us. If he doesn't shut up, he'll die." And I responded back that yes, you had met the men in brown. The men in brown are basically a church security black ops group that come out and threaten, intimidate, and sometimes blood atone for those people who say too much. And I said that they know that the porcine protocols are not in church hands, and they are looking for it. But it is in the protection of, and I can't remember the action. It was a Latin phrase, but translated, it meant the mystical fraternity of Mormon cola drinkers. But I didn't give the translation. I just gave the Latin name, that this is the group that is in possession of it. Yes, I am a member of it, and I've probably said too much already. If you don't hear from me, you know, in the next few days, I may no longer be in this world. And there were, I don't remember how many, but even if there were just one, but there were many more than one, submissions to the list asking where they could find a copy of the Porcine Protocols. And it suddenly dawned on me, you know, I never put a smiley face once on any of those messages. So they actually had taken the thing very seriously. And I felt that, okay, this is the kind of irresponsibility that I condemn on, you know, the internet. So I actually had to everybody who I sent them a private message, this was a joke. You know, there really is no such thing. I was kidding around. And but it ballooned even beyond that. There was no stopping it. Are you? I had actually made mention that there's a used bookstore in Ogden, on Washington Boulevard, that actually has the copy. It's however in Latin. It's not the English translation. And it was and I was talking about a real object, a real artifact. It's basically a terracotta or porcelain thing. It looked like a book with a pentagram on it, and it was set up on the shelf. And I remember seeing that, and so I just said, you know, that actually you can see it, but they won't take it down to show it to you. And I was in this particular store one day, and the manager came up to me and said, "Hey, do you know anything about the Porcine Protocols?" I said, "What?" And he said, "I'm getting calls to see if I have a copy of this thing." And I said, "Yeah, it's that book right up there." And he said, "That's not a book." And I explained the whole story, and he just split a gut. So, you know, there are those sorts of things that it can occur. That are quite humorous, but sometimes are a little irresponsible, because I would really hate for someone out there with a tender testimony to really think that there are, you know, that there's a black op in church security, and if there is, I know nothing about it. Let me just get on the topic of I want to stick on mailing lists. One thing that I've noticed, and Keith Irwin mentioned this to me this morning, and it has been something that I have noticed. Originally, when we first, you know, when Mormons first got on the internet, we had Mormonel, and there was the discussion group on Genie, the one in CompuServe, and they were very general. I mean, people who were just LDS came online and discussed whatever they wanted to discuss online. So it was a generalized community. And the mailing lists have now diverged from that, and we see a greater degree of specialization, i.e. the LDS bookshelf, which even had to split and become more specialized in and of itself. The true book collectors and the guys who just want to argue about, you know, the content of the books. And LDS Phil is a very good example. You know, I mean, how many LDS philosophers are there really in the world today? I think both of them are here making presentations, but it's a very highly specialized group, and there are mailing lists for primary teaching advice, that sort of thing. But we've sort of lost that general landscape. Everybody's into their specialized lists. And there's a reason for that, I think, that I remember that when I first joined the CompuServe group that Keith, in fact, started, I got a couple of messages a day and found it very interesting and very fun. But it wasn't very long, just a few months. I was getting hundreds of messages a day. People had discovered it, gotten online, and so I just thought, you know, I don't even have the time to go through and read the topic threads. And I would just start deleting, you know, the several messages I'd gotten that day, hoping I'll get around to them sometime. And it became very troublesome that way. I on Mormon Phil, I probably get maybe one or two a day. Which for me is a blessing, because you can really be inundated with a lot of information. So maybe that's why we've gotten into that specialization. But then there is that. I do have some nostalgia for the general conversation that went on in the earlier, more general communities. Let's talk about church control. I think what Scott was referring to when he talked about the closure of unofficial sites was, in fact, the closure of official sites, not unofficial sites. In other words, other than the central web page, there were a lot of ward and stake web pages that were out there, and they were considered official representatives of the church. And then the church asked them to shut down, not permanently, but until the church could devise some structure, some recommended structure and recommended content and those sorts of things, and advice as to what not to post on the church websites. The individual stake and ward websites. And so that was the closure there. We got a lot of mail at Mormon Village, why aren't you closing down, as per the church's instructions. Well, we are an unofficial Mormon website. We don't represent the church. We have no affiliation with the church other than personal in our own lives. But I was general manager for a company called LDS.net, which offered filtered internet service to people who wanted to get on the internet but didn't want to get pornography or any kind of offensive material. We were in operation about 3 years when I decided to trademark the name LDS.net. And church legal department was apparently notified by the government that we were trying to trademark the name, and immediately an injunction was placed upon the trademark, and so we met with an elderly gentleman who was close to retirement, and very gracious man, and we discussed it, we talked about it, and the owners of LDSnet actually offered to just once we realized what the problem was, and the problem wasn't that we were trying to trademark it, they didn't want us using the name LDS.net, and we explained to them, you know, the rational reasons why we couldn't do this. You change your name, you lose all your customers because they all want to maintain that email address. That's basically why people stick with an ISP, not because they give you great service, but, well, that's my email address, and I don't want to have to tell the 300 people that I emailed to, this is my new address. So we asked, could we grandfather out the name? We could change our name to something else and grandfather the email address, that suffix, and just let normal attrition do away with that. And the gentleman said, that's a good suggestion. Let me take that under advisement. Well, he retired, and we got this kind of a young, ambitious lawyer in there who, I believe, mistook our spirit of cooperation for weakness. Basically smelled blood, and he went for the jugular. And he said, no, you can't grandfather the name. I'll give you 6 months, you know, to change your name. And this despite the fact that there was no moral or legal reason we should change our name. We're not, you know, Church of Jesus Christ, it's LDS.net. There was concern over the fact that we called ourselves Your Liahona to the internet. I mean, the concept behind that was, you know, that you're not going to go to the bad sites. You're going to be led to the good sites. They didn't want us using that name. They didn't want us using a graphic of a Liahona that an artist had drawn. And
you didn't have a picture of you.
Well, I asked him to see it. I said, is it in the president's vault? Because if it's not that close to the real thing, I don't see what you're upset about. And, yeah, you find that funny. He didn't. The upshot was, and then we were told finally in a letter that we were really upsetting their legal department because we hadn't responded as quickly as we should have. I think by this time it had gone out to the outside legal service, not the internal department, legal department, and got a nice letter from McConkie, McConkie, and McConkie, and it basically said you haven't responded to us. Oh, by the way, we don't want you using the name Mormon Village. This struck me as very odd, so I went on to the internet and I looked up all of the domain names I could find that had the word Mormon, or Mormons, or Mormonism, LDS, Latter-day Saints, I found one called LDSChurch.something or other. I can't remember. I think they had purchased all three extensions, and I found one called Mormon Church. You know, Mormon Village seemed to be so much less problematic than Mormon Church or LDS Church. Every one of them wrote me back. I emailed all of these domain owners. Every one of them, including the people from Mormon Church and LDS Church, wrote me back and said, no, we have not been approached by the church. And it suddenly dawned on me that the reason why we'd been singled out is because I'd tried to trademark the name. Had I just not even worried about it, these legals who probably are just trying to justify their exorbitant salaries felt they had to do something. I mean, it really makes me laugh. If the guy really realized, he must realize, I shouldn't say if he realized, he knows how dinky we were, and he knows how innocuous we were, but he probably didn't have anything on his desk at the moment and knew that he wasn't going to have something on his desk, so I'm just going to go after these guys and, you know, be a hero. And we have since sold LDSNet to a company that promises to fight the church, and apparently the church is going to take them to court over the name LDS.net. The difficulty in doing that, it may end up that this young man will do himself more harm than good by following through with this, is that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not own the name Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Actually, it's the Strangites in Voorhees that actually owned the name and still own the name today. And that's why you will see that they will write the name without a hyphen and with a capital D. So there's a latter space day saints, whereas we have now made the D smaller and put a hyphen in. And unfortunately, that distinction would not hold up in court. That would be a trademark violation. But the two groups have made amenable agreements. You don't mess with us, we won't mess with you. If that were to have been brought up in court, I'm sure the judge would have looked at the church lawyer and said, what is this? Why are you doing this? But nonetheless, we were forced to sell. We were a subsidiary of another company that does business in the Mormon community, and the owner did not want to risk the chance of it getting into the papers that a company that he was affiliated with was in litigation with the church. I did kind of note with a smile that he actually made a contractual arrangement with the people that bought the company that they would not give up the name, that they would fight for it. So, yeah, exactly. But the I think this may set a precedent. I really do think it was just a fluke. Like I say, we just stuck our heads above ground, and they noticed us. I should say somebody noticed us. And this may just be a fluke, but it may be the indication of a trend where because the church is very worried about controlling where non-members go to, so that they don't think they're actually on a legitimate Mormon site, an official Mormon site, when they're not. And I understand that desire perfectly, but I think there's going to be a lot of I think there's going to be some litigation and a lot of wrangling before that's finally settled. Anyway, that's what I've got. Pardon? I forgot.
Segregation of ritual and non-ritual communities. We have till 12:45, and I'm going to talk till before 12:30, so there's going to be more than 15 minutes, or at least 15 minutes. Mormons have a negative opinion about computer geeks like me. They say that we communicate via computer because we don't have the social skills to make real friends. They say that we have time to spend online because we are inactive in the Mormon Church. They say that we discuss Mormon issues on the internet because we are doubters, skeptics, or worse. Did you know that the word Netscape is the alphabetic equivalent to the number 666? It follows that the internet must be not simply the road, but the superhighway to apostasy. I believe that there is a lot of doubt, a lot of chaos, and a lot of dissenters. I also believe that their existence is extremely positive, both for society and for Mormonism. But it seems to me that the most negative stereotype about ritual communities is that we are a bunch of guys typing banalities on the keyboard. According to this stereotype, virtual communities are not real. If I could convey to you a single concept today, it would be that virtual communities are real. They are not only forums to exchange ideas, but also tools to transform society. In 1993, when church members presented 1,000 roses to the general authorities of the church, they organized themselves through the internet. In July 2000, when a group of Sunstone subscribers started to send letters and petitions to the Sunstone Board of Trustees, they organized themselves through the internet. In December 2000, when a group of gay-supportive Mormons published in the Salt Lake Tribune a petition to the general authorities of the church, they organized themselves through the internet. The moral is clear. Be aware of nerdy types like me who spend their evenings surfing the net, because sometimes we can raise a lot of hell. Another example of how the internet can promote a sense of community and even help create eternal relationships is a website called LDSSingles.com, an online dating service tailored specifically for Mormons. The site is wildly popular, has 25,000 current subscribers, and it has recently been featured in the Salt Lake City Weekly in an article entitled Marriage by Modem. Let me say right off the bat that it's almost embarrassing how little has been written about Mormons. The web is not only changing the way Mormons interact, but it's also created a new field in sociology called cyber sociology. For those interested in this field, I strongly recommend two pioneering books, Cyber Society, edited by Stephen G. Jones, and Communities in Cyberspace, edited by Mark A. Smith and Peter Kolak. There is also an internet periodical called Cyber Sociology Magazine that was published between 1997 and 1999 and is still online. Although I don't want to bother you with bibliography, I also would like to mention some Mormon-specific resources that are out there. One is a book by Laura Mary Gold, Mormons on the Internet. In her book, Laura Mary envisions a worldwide community of Latter-day Saints that includes the devout and the skeptical, the active and the inactive, the married and the single, the straight and the gay. I commend Laura Mary for such a wide vision. I also would like to mention an excellent article by Sheldon Greaves called Cyber Saints, Mormon Settlements on the Electronic Frontier. As far as I know, Sheldon was the first one to acknowledge the incredible potential not only to create Mormon discourse and scholarship, but also to do activism and promote social change. His article was published in Sunstone in September 1994. Finally, there are also some very good resources in tapes of past Sunstone symposiums. In 1993, Brent Wilson moderated a panel on Mormonel, and in 1995, Lynn Matthews Anderson organized a session about ELWC, a mailing list also known as the Word from Hell. Finally, I have to mention that Lee Paulson from California, who is here today with us, has recently conducted some research on the ways that the internet affects LDS people who are active in the church. He made a presentation this year in Sunstone West, and the tape is also available for sale. Now I would like to make a few remarks about one of the most intriguing aspects of virtual Mormonism, the issue of separation and segregation. I want to ask the following question. Are virtual and non-virtual Mormon communities segregated? Here I'm using the word community in its widest meaning. Examples of non-virtual Mormon communities would be LDS Wars, Institutes of Religion, Returned Missionary Reunions, and scholarly forums such as the Association for Mormon Letters, Sandstone, and Dialogue. Examples of virtual communities would be Mormon mailing lists, Mormon chat rooms, and even Mormon websites, especially in as much as they have interactive features, and they foster a sense of community and solidarity. To a certain extent, the segregation we see between virtual and non-virtual communities is analogous to the segregation that we see in other social realms. Virtual and non-virtual communities are segregated, most of all, because they use different media and they engender different cultures. I will illustrate this with my own experience. In the last few years, I have written several papers. Some of them will be published in Dialogue, and some of them will be posted on the Internet. It is only natural that when I write a paper for Dialogue, I will try to include bibliographical references to other papers that were published in Dialogue, Sandstone, and the like. That, the way I see it, this is not only a question of conviction, and perhaps not even a question of convention. It is most of all a question of convenience. If I write in Dialogue, it's logical to assume that my reader may have easy access to other issues of Dialogue. Conversely, when I write a paper to be posted on the website or type an email message, I will prefer to use as references links to other internet sources rather than printed bibliography, because I already know that my reader has easy access to the internet. What we have to understand is that virtual and non-virtual communities don't merely occupy different spaces. They are different types of space altogether. They entail different sets of protocols, etiquettes, and expectations. For instance, in Sandstone or Dialogue, a simple exchange of opinions typically takes between 3 months and 1 year. On the internet, an exchange of opinions typically takes 24 hours. In the printed media, anonymity is discouraged. On the internet, anonymity is tolerated and sometimes even encouraged. In the printed media, once you publish a document, you can never change its contents. On the internet, discourse occupies a fluid space somewhere between written and spoken discourse. You can post your opinions on a web page, but you can also go back to that web page and change what you have written. Most strikingly, books and magazines tend to occupy always the same real space in libraries, even the same shelf and the same call number. Web pages, on the other hand, tend to change their location in cyberspace, and they often disappear without leaving a trace. Therefore, it's not surprising that those who grew up using traditional research tools, such as books and periodicals, will always find the internet a little bit unsafe. Now, since the web is in part a question of the question of promoting an alternative culture, it is only natural that some people will find it attractive, while others will avoid it like the plague. I remember, for instance, my surprise when I met Mormon historian Michael Quinn, and he confessed to me that he didn't have an email address. I was shocked. How does this guy survive, I thought. Of course, the fact that Michael Quinn doesn't have an email address doesn't mean that he doesn't use the internet to conduct research. It simply means that he prefers phone calls and letters over email. Now, I will say a few words about the demographics of Mormon cyberspace. I don't know of a single paper or a single study dealing with this, but I think it's reasonable to assume that, in general, virtual Mormon communities are younger, more liberal, and more democratically inclined than non-virtual communities. Generally speaking, people who surf the net don't care if a web page has been created by someone with religious, moral, or academic authority. They judge what they read based more on its contents and less on the name of the author. Needless to say, the internet is an extraordinary tool for minority groups. Women, intellectuals, gays and lesbians, they all can network across the world and explore different issues without the fear of being censored or disciplined. On the area of research, one area of research that remains largely ignored is the presence of women in the Mormon cyberspace. From Arta Johnson to Laura Mary Gold to Lynn Matthews Anderson, the LDS women are not just surfing the net. They are creating websites, launching mailing lists, and networking across the world. No one knows for sure why so many LDS women go online. My speculation is that most Mormon women hate the competition and the pettiness associated with hierarchical institutions. They simply prefer to network horizontally. Now, are virtual and non-virtual communities talking only among themselves, or are they talking to each other? Here, I believe there is a great asymmetry. My impression is that online communities are quick to discuss and make reference to non-virtual communities, whereas in non-virtual communities, it often takes years to acknowledge the existence of their virtual counterparts. Take, for instance, the magazine Dialogue. Although email addresses are starting to appear in the list of contributors, they haven't yet published a single scholarly paper discussing the impact that the internet is having on Mormonism. Sanson, in that sense, is really breaking the mold. And I think they deserve to be commended for that. Not only do they publish a regular column on Cyber Saints, but they also include email addresses next to the names of the authors. And they are in the process of creating an impressive, massive, interactive website. Which brings me to my next point. The strongest evidence against segregation precisely comes from amphibious communities. That is, communities that have two lives. They are part virtual and part non-virtual. And as a matter of fact, I would venture to say that the most remarkable fact about traditional Mormon communities is that most of them are in the process of becoming amphibious, with virtual and non-virtual components growing closer together. Today, the Family History Library has a website. The Association for Mormon Letters has a very active mailing list. Every mission in the world has now a webpage where returned missionaries can reconnect. At this pace, it wouldn't surprise me a bit if the Association of Mormons Against Technology announces tomorrow the launching of their website. It is fascinating to see how different types of Mormon have reacted to the advent of the internet. Liberals and moderates tend to see the net as a blessing. Orthodox and conservatives tend to see it as a danger, and many have created conservative websites in a reactionary move. The official church itself sees the internet both as a curse and a blessing, but conservatives will always view the web with suspicion, because on the internet, freedom of speech is supreme. It seems to me that both virtual and non-virtual communities have an extraordinary potential to bring positive change to Mormonism. Virtual and non-virtual are perhaps like Adam and Eve the day after the fall. They may fight, criticize, or ignore each other, but someday they will realize that they are doomed to be together forever. Eventually, they will begin to flirt, and who knows, perhaps the day will come when Adam and Eve, virtual and non-virtual, will finally mate and replenish the earth. We have 20 minutes for questions, and I invite everyone to get close and use the mic so that the question gets recorded and we don't need to read.
This has been an interesting session because I've been in Oklahoma for 26 years, and one thing that I have not heard today is what I think is one of the prime benefits of internet communities is that it allows people in the diaspora, so to speak, to become part of communities in the areas where the church is more solidly established. Professionally, I'm a scientist, and I find the Iring L gives me a chance to interact with other scientists on subjects in which I'm interested, but where the critical mass of LDS scientists where I live is just not there. I'm wondering if any of you have any comments on the effect of the internet in disseminating some of the more interesting and, let's not say oddball, but some of the couple standard deviations away from the mean types of habits and thinking patterns across the Mormon diaspora. And in a sense, it's serving as a seed to pass those ideas to all kinds of areas where they would not ordinarily have gone on their own by the old process.
There is definitely, there is an advantage to be had on the internet by those who are outside of Utah and or most especially outside of the United States. It seems to me that the distance is certainly closed by the internet, and one can feel more up on data. For example, there is a mailing list called Mormon News that has stringers. They don't write the articles, but they live all around the world, and they submit newspaper articles that have something to do with Mormons or Mormonism or a Mormon who had just died or something like that. And you read it and it's so cosmopolitan. I mean, there are things that I wouldn't have ever even known had happened had it not been for that. So there's a great deal of advantage in that, in being able to keep up not only with what's going on, at 50 East North Temple, but what's going on out in Oklahoma? What's going on in Germany, in England? There's a lot of advantage to that, I think. Did that answer your question?
Can you
Oh, how do people get on Mormon News? They have a website. I believe it's just www.mormonnews.com.
Hugo does mention about the freedom of expression on the internet, and you mentioned that church control of the internet is happening, and I just wondered if there's any thoughts on what is happening right now, what might happen in the future, maybe from...
My comment is that regarding this issue with the church asking wars and stakes not to post web pages, my feel is that this is bad because what is happening is that demographically, now you have even more, the comparison is that you have more anti-Mormon websites, independent websites and web pages, than Mormon ones, because all the Mormons... And the other thing that is happening is that some individual people feel that if wars and stakes are not allowed to publish independent web pages, they shouldn't either. So this is all, in my opinion, is really bad for the church. They have probably a good intention. Maybe it's related to the whole correlation movement. But I think in one sense it's bad.
I think that I think it should be acknowledged, though, that the church has not tried to control free speech. It hasn't tried to control the dissident sites. It hasn't tried to control the unofficial sites. The reason why the church actually asked these official sites to shut down until they could reach some kind of normative recommendation was based upon the publication online of material that the church didn't feel was appropriate. Not any way whatsoever. But I do think that they may be looking. My example for, about the difficulties that LDSnet had with the legal department illustrates the possibility that there may be that the church may participate in trying to buy up or be gifted, be donated those domain names that somehow pertain or ring of officialdom, and insofar as people on the internet who are monitoring. No one has suggested that, but I mean that kind of is a logical extension of your question. I don't think that's happening, quite honestly. I mean, I've heard about it here at Sunstone. You know that there's representatives of the church that come and check up on what's being said and that sort of thing. And I kind of doubt that, quite honestly. It makes for a good story, but I really don't know that that's really happening. Now, again, publications are different. Those can be handed around and can be discussed and can be redmarked. But email, that sort of thing, what's posted on websites, the only thing that I've ever seen the church do in terms of going after a website other than the domain name is content. And I got a form letter a long time ago asking, you know, us to remove all of the LDS property from our website, and I went through and I couldn't find any, and I think they just saw Mormon Village and kind of just sent the envelope out. And I wrote the guy back and said, we don't have the proclamation of the family, we don't have the Relief Society proclamation, I don't think we even had the Articles of Faith up at that time, and which are really public domain, but I didn't get a response back. I just said, if you could tell me where it is, I'll take it off, because our site had become rather large, and I wasn't at all sure that maybe we didn't have something that belonged, you know, was intellectual property of the church. But I think those are the things that the church is concerned about, and I don't think that there's any going to be exercise of control over what's said on the internet by individual Mormons.
Exactly.
It's been mentioned that the two items that were mentioned in as reasons for the closure, the temporary closure, I want to underscore, of the official stake and ward sites were that copyrighted material was being published, and that put the church in jeopardy. And what was the second one, Keith? Oh, they wanted one standard look and feel for these various sites, and then it's also been mentioned that membership lists were being published, and there were some problems with that.
Yes, I have a small comment and a question. When I first learned of the closure of the official sites, we were in a symposium at the Y, and the general authority explained that to us. And he was pretty expansive, and beyond the things you've mentioned, he mentioned that some of the ingenious newsletters that were showing up were talking about the excommunications and the details and so on. And that would drive any lawyer, and I'm an ex-lawyer, and I can tell you that'd drive us nuts to have that sort of thing there and then have to defend lawsuits against it. So I do think that the church has quite a challenge in trying to regularize this a little bit. Now, my question goes to the usefulness of the Internet beyond what I've heard you discuss. When I was on the High Council in our state, we had a fairly progressive situation where our assignments were put out on the net, and our state presidents used it as a productivity tool. And I guess I'm wondering if anybody has any experience beyond just using the Internet as scheduling and making us more efficient, because, you know, I think we've all had ennui and a certain amount of exhaustion in our church experience with the endless meetings and so on. We found in a couple of experiences, I'm talking now personally, the Internet was just an outstanding way to regularize our meetings, set up agendas. We literally had leadership that had the agenda, and we knew what we were to do before we went to the meeting, and it was just a marvelous experience to see how the net literally regularized what had become, in my experience over time, just a horrible waste of time. Any comments on that as a productivity tool, and how can we utilize it that more that way?
Well, I don't know if you'd count this as part of the net, but some people have different ideas about whether email is counted as part of the net or not, and how that fits in. But right now, I'm the state clerk in our state, and I can tell you that I, as a state clerk and our executive secretary, that we use that quite extensively, the email purposes, in order to set up agendas and set up minutes and those type of, and so it has made things for me especially very much easier to do, because wherein I had to before call each of the high councilmen and each of the bishops and each of, and I had to try to find them at the right time at home and that type of it was very difficult, where now I can send out to my mailing list, I can send it out to all of the bishops and the high councilmen, and then just sit back and wait for 2 days until they all respond to that. And so I agree that there is definitely a positive side to that, and that there is some efficiency things that definitely could come with the use of the Internet in that way. Yeah, we don't have a stake website, but we do use email, and we have to be very careful with, of course, what we post and what kind of information that we disseminate via email, but basic items, agenda items, basically. Yes, he says they're particularly useful for large stakes. I agree. I'm from Texas, so I can, I go with you there. Some of our stake meetings, we have to drive a full hour and a half to get out to the, and it's definitely much more helpful.
Basically, I'm agreeing with you guys. Our stake does the same thing too, and I guess we take it one step further on the High Council. The state secretary actually sends out name approvals, and so by the time the meeting comes, names have already been approved.
Amazing.
In fact, one high counselor actually had to get an email. He was the only one who didn't have one, and we were doing it this way. But probably, at least in my experience, the one church-related internet email-related has been the most modern that I've been in so far. Was one Sunday, it was for Mother's Day in our ward. All the men do all the lessons in all the organizations our ward does. And I said, yeah, I'd be willing to do that. And later on, for Mother's Day, I get this email, and it's from a primary teacher. And, no, actually, it's a primary president, and she CC'd the primary teacher and said, this is the class that we'd like you to teach. And then she gave me a URL for the church's website, which was the lesson for that day in full text, and said, here's the lesson. And that was it. That was all they wanted was my acknowledgement. And so without ever even talking to a person, I showed up on Mother's Day and gave a lesson to this class. And it had all been done by including the text. I guess my questions all are more related with kind of this cultural thing of the church, of the web. In some of my surveys, about half people said that it made no difference. The other half had said that it did make a big difference, in particular, that, you know, the
finding people.
And in my own experience, I have this circle of friends, most of them in California, but it seems like wherever I go, like I go on a business trip to Colorado, and I went to Boulder, and I just kind of mentioned this once on one of these private lists that developed. I'm also looking, this is a second question, of anyone doing a sociological of the Mormon Internet starting from the beginning, because I see this kind of general thing that happened, and then it was like, you know, like the real church, all these schisms developed early on, and then, of course, other things have come in, all the specialized. But there's still these schisms, conservative lists, ultra-liberal ones, the gay lists, you know, and then there's these, like, private ones. I always called them doubly private, because they actually left the private list to form their own little groups, you know, and they're like networks of friends. And some of these people that are actually here at Sunstone today, you know, I count them as my friends. We celebrate birthdays together, you know. If we ever end up there, I kind of mentioned on one I was going on this business trip, and one said, hey, I live there. You're coming to dinner tonight, you know, that night, you know. And so then I tell my people at work, you know, I already have someone to see. And they're going, well, who, you know? Oh, a friend. So anyway, I was wondering if any of you had any comment on that kind of
thing. Maybe I will make a brief comment. I belong to a list that has been accused of being all the bad things that you can think of. It's a private list. It's called ELWC+, and it originated as a feminist list, but it includes a lot. We talk about different topics, and I think it's an example of how you really create a community, because we do. I was listing the things that Mark listed, and I think that his list of things that people do with the internet, the Mormon community does, is excellent. And it seems to me that we have done everything, you know, from talking about genealogy to thrashing and bashing. So it ends up that if you find a small group of people, you end up being a community that can effectively do many of the things that non-virtual communities do. That is my comment. Yes?
I wanted to...
That might be the last question.
Okay. I'll try and make it a good one then. I want to just respond to a couple of productivity tools and then pick a couple of nits with, if I could, with a couple of comments made by the panel. I live in San Jose, South Stake, which we feature as a piece of Silicon Valley, at least. And a website was a very integral part of how we did things in our stake until it was closed down. Now, essentially, email has replaced that. But our bishopric meetings, for example, with the stake president, have been reduced from an hour and a half to about 30 minutes. Largely because all of the announcement kinds of things or explanation kinds of things are sent out ahead of time via email, and unless somebody has something they really want to snivel about, it just doesn't come up in that meeting. And it's just one for bishops. It's a wonderful thing. I'm also aware one of my first friends on the internet was Robert Slavin, who lives in. Some of you may have met him if you're on the net. He was the only Mormon 5-day winner of Jeopardy that I know. But Robert also lives in Yellowknife, Northwest Territory. And Robert's the first one who raised the issue with me about the notion of using the email as a vehicle for home teaching people who may live 300 miles away from you in your branch. And from that, I took the notion and actually did serve as a virtual home teacher for somebody that was in distress that I met on the net who didn't have a home teacher. So I think there's some real possibilities there. My nitpicking, the notion of a community that includes gay, straight, liberal, conservative, active, inactive, excommunicated, traditional, non-traditional Mormons in Laura Mary Gold's book was not a vision of the future. I wrote the foreword to that book, and it was a description of the community on CompuServe that we had. Still the richest experience I've ever had, and that was pre-internet. So that's my one nit. The other nit is when you get to the church website,